Hello, and welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is delighted to welcome back one of my favorite authors, Jerry Croteau, whose new book, The Kielbasa Killer, debuts in July. Before we begin, I'd like to let those listening in know the Poison Pen does have copies of The Kielbasa Killer on order, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put one in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we'll be happy to connect you with this truly wonderful start to a series. And now I'd like to welcome Jerry.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today. I always like to start with authors a little bit about their life before they became published, and you have a rather fascinating background in service in the military. What can you tell us about your life before writing?
Yeah, before writing, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and then I wanted to serve in the military, and I didn't get into the Naval Academy when I first applied as a senior, and I was going to enlist, and my guidance counselor pulled me aside and said, don't enlist. You've been offered a scholarship. And there was this thing called the Naval Academy Foundation. And I got $1,000 from them, which paid for me to go to SUNY at Buffalo, State University of New York at Buffalo, for a year. Plus I had a Regent scholarship. So I was really fortunate. I worked in a local grocery store, top supermarket, that year. And with the hope that I would get in the next year. The reason I didn't get in, I was qualified, but my congressman at the time, who was Jack Kemp, Buffalonians know him because he also played football for the Buffalo Bills, but he was a popular congressman, I think, too. And at any rate, he had too many women there. There was a quota system then. And all this came back to me recently because I met with the women I graduated with in Asheville, North Carolina. We did a reunion that we had planned to do before the pandemic and shutdown. So we finally had it this year. And I had never been to Asheville, North Carolina before. And boy, talk about a beautiful place and hiking in the mountains. And of course, I was envisioning dead bodies on the hiking trail. There were 31 of us there, and we graduated, I think it was 62 or 63 women in our class of about 1,000 men. So yeah, my life beforehand, I served in the Navy for 9 years. I wrote, that was part of my job as an intelligence officer, was to write up descriptions of things. Of course, they had to be factual, just the facts, and brief. So it took me a long time to learn that just being able to write grammatically and putting basic plot points down is not enough for a fiction genre writing career. So yeah, that's what I did. And then I was a Navy wife after that. My husband served for 27 years before he retired. And we've been here in central Pennsylvania for about 12 years. Actually, we're almost exactly at 12 years. I can't believe it. And we moved here from, dare I say, Russia was our last tour. At the U.S. Embassy, which is pretty empty right now, is my understanding. But, you know, that was my previous life. Of course, I pay attention to current events, but my life now is 100% writing, family, two dogs that were training. That's a whole nother story that has to go in a book. And yeah, who's training? We pay dearly to get the dogs trained and we're doing it, but it's really, we're the ones that are being trained. My parrot, two adult children that we try to spend time with as much as possible. And the Phillies, which I surprised my husband with tickets to the Phillies this past week. All four of us went. It was nice to have two adult children there too. And they lost in the 10th inning. Yeah, but they could still do it. They can still come back.
That's true. You may have launched yourself into a career in the military, but you thought about writing since you were young. If I remember correctly, Stephen King kind of prompted the idea to become a writer.
Yeah, well, I think Dr. Seuss, because I remember writing in second grade a story that got a lot of attention, and I illustrated it too from my teachers. And then I did our class newsletter in fifth grade, which what I remember about that mostly was learning to draw a frog, because I don't know why frog was important to me at that time, and birds. I've always loved birds. But yeah, Stephen King, I was 12 years old, seventh grade, and that was when we had the blizzard of 77, which was right about when I started reading him. And I just, I don't know, I always thought, I thought I might write horror someday, actually. And I also, I read romances voraciously. I started reading those at age 9. I stole one off my mother's nightstand, but it was a candlelight romance, which people who read romance genre will know, it was very basic. There was a chaste kiss at the end. And that first book was Night Duty Nurse. And oh. I need to look up the author again. I did find a cover when I Googled it online. I found the cover that I remembered it being a picture of a nurse with the nurse's cap. Mm-hmm. I need to tell my daughter about this because she's an RN now. So she would find that fascinating. And of course, back then, nurses, they were not glorified the way they need to be. Nobody realized, you know, how much hard work they do and heavy lifting.
So you decided to become a writer, and eventually you took that path. What was it like getting your first book published? That was in 2007.
Yes, you have a good memory, John. I wrote a book. I started writing that book maybe in 95, somewhere around 95. Oh. So I had about a 65,000 word novel in 1999 when a friend told me that I had to join Romance Writers of America because it was so great with networking and meeting editors, agents, and of course the craft of storytelling. So we were stationed in Memphis, Tennessee, and they had a really strong chapter there. Patricia Potter lived in my neighborhood, and she was had served on the board many times. And Carolyn McSparren was the other person. She used to write for Super Romance, and she was also in Sisters in Crime. Why I didn't listen to her then to join Sisters in Crime, I don't know. Probably I felt overwhelmed as a Navy spouse and trying to establish a writing career. So yeah, it was a lot. So 1999, let's see, I joined the local chapter, which was the River Romance Writers and River City in Memphis. And in 2000, I went to my first national conference, which was in Washington, D.C. And it was amazing. I had never been in the presence of so many writers. It just blew me away. And then, you know, the rest is history. I just kept going back and forth. That first book was heartily or handily rejected by agents and publishers, but I was naive. I didn't realize that the rejection from Harlequin Super Romance was actually a really good one. It wasn't a form letter. And the agent told me I needed to look at writing inspirational fiction because I had an angel in the book, but it wasn't an inspirational book that way. It was just that I was putting everything but the kitchen sink in it. I didn't know it was my first story. So that story never sold and it shouldn't have. It took me 6 years of submitting. And I got the call in May of 2006. We were stationed in Belgium at the time. And the book has a World War II theme in it. So it was appropriate that I was there. That was a special time.
So now first that brings off. Us to 2023, and you're debuting a new mystery series with a kielbasa killer. What can you tell us about that book?
So this book is my first hardcover ever, and I love it. I love the cover. What the publisher did is they incorporated Polish folk art, and then you can see the kielbasas dancing around, the idea being that with subsequent books, there'd be a different, not sausage, maybe another food, type of food or something related to Polish American culture in Western New York in 1982. And I do know what this is going to be in the second book, but I can't say yet. And we can talk a little bit about that second book later. But so in this book, I'm introducing you to Lydia Winooski Lydia grew up in Western New York. She's 29, which it seems to be a common age of romance heroines and protagonists in cozy mysteries. And she wants to run her own bakery and cafe, serving Polish American fare. She's more of a baker than a cook. And she has saved all her money and many years to go up to the precursor to the Cordon Bleu in Canada. Unfortunately, she either gets kicked out or quits. And that's, we're trying to figure out through this story what exactly happened. She's very stubborn and she doesn't like to really give away what happened. But we do find out mostly through this book. You'll definitely find out in the second book what really happened with her. And Madame Delphine is her instructor there, and really her mental nemesis even now as she's back in Buffalo. So she comes back to Buffalo and thinks, okay, that didn't work, but at least I can open my own place. And she had, since she's been gone, Grandma Mary has moved in to the upstairs garage apartment that Lydia had been living in with her parents. Lydia had been working in her dad's butcher shop, the Wynuski's Wieners and Meats, that is a family store in Chickawaga, which is a suburb of Buffalo, New York. And so she figures she'll just come back, and there's no way she wants to go back to work in the butcher shop. She'll just get going with her business. And Grandma wants to support her and help give her the down payment to buy a place, and a restaurant on the lake, Lake Erie, actually becomes available. So it all looks great, except Lydia's father has a stroke on Christmas, and it's up to her to save the family business. She finds out by going into butcher, which she knows will be temporary. Her father fortunately will recover from his stroke. And I drew on, my grandfather had a stroke in the 70s and he came back from it. You know, and this, the technology now is so much more advanced with stroke, but I wrote this book and, you know, it was brought back a lot of memories of my grandpa and how he healed, but they do have to wait for Pop to get his butchering hand back. So Lydia is doing both. She's juggling the butcher shop and trying to open her own business, which just seems a bridge too far. And she's rooming with her grandmother, who she loves dearly, but it does cut in on both their social lives. Grandma's widowed. The reason Grandma's living there is because she sold her home of many years, many decades, after her husband died, her beloved husband, because she met a new man and they were going to Florida together, but he jilted her. So Grandma's got an axe to grind there. But so Lydia and Grandma are rooming together, and they're actually very good roomies and besties in all the best ways. And that's how I remember my Polish grandmother. And she was American. She was born here. But I always think of her as my Polish grandmother because she spoke Polish, cooked Polish. It was a very close community, which actually fragmented in at the last third of her life and as I became an adult. And so that would have been more in the 90s that happened, because that's what happens after cultures, you know, assimilate. And it's kind of sad. You lose that strength of whatever culture it is. But I mean, you can look at it sad or just, it's just the way it goes. But here I am, how many years later, and still touting my Polish American heritage. So we don't lose everything.
So Lydia is running the butcher shop, mm-hmm. and we have to mention at least a little bit about the body that crops up.
Yes. So Lydia, it's Easter weekend. And Easter is a big deal in Buffalo, New York. Whether you are an observant Catholic or not, or partake in any religious observances, it's all about the food in Buffalo, and probably the drink too. So fresh kielbasa is a traditional Polish dish around Easter time, and especially Easter morning breakfast. That's how I remember it. And fresh kielbasa is different from smoked, in that smoked, you can get smoked kielbasa anywhere in the grocery store today, even, but fresh is harder to come by because it doesn't travel well. It has to be cooked, you know, it'd be like fresh ground pork anywhere. It has to be cooked properly so people don't get sick, that kind of thing. So she's nervous about having enough kielbasa. She knew she had enough fresh, but she's worried about the smoke. And there is a commercial smoker adjacent to the butcher shop, but that's full and she's already used that. So she makes a little extra batch, Lydia does. She smokes it the night before and she puts a batch in the family smoker, which is in the backyard. And where I grew up in Chickawaga, people had smokers in their backyards. I didn't realize what they really were until I lived overseas, was stationed overseas, and the Italian family had a pizza oven in their backyard, which until we were stationed in Naples, Italy, and we went in someone's, you know, a local's backyard for a pizza party. I'm like, oh my gosh, now I get it. That's why those neighbors had that. That's what they knew, you know? So very cool things. I wish I had known more about that as a kid. I would have been begging that neighbor to make me pizza. But at any rate, Lydia has the smoked kielbasa in the smoker, goes back from the butcher shop to get it, and runs into a dead body on the floor of the smoker. And it has the family's sausage pricker in its neck, the body does. So yeah, so of course Lydia and grandma look like prime suspects, since they live in the garage right next to the smoker. And then several other suspects come up. And what I love most about the scene where the police show up is that Detective Harry Nowicki shows up. And Lydia and her grandma Mary, they love to watch detective shows on TV. And this allowed me to do a deep dive into 1970s and 80s popular TV shows. And Grandma Mary kind of sees herself as Angie Dickinson in Policewoman. And, you know, of course, then Detective Nowicki shows up, and Grandma knows Detective Nowicki from grade school. And so sparks fly, much to Lydia's dismay, because she's like, you know, she thinks Grandma's going overboard. But there is some genuine affection there that does blossom into more romance as the story goes on and as the next book happens. So yeah, I love that scene where they all meet. And also Lydia's cousin Ned is a local Chictawaga police officer as well.
It's a fascinating book, not just a great mystery, but I know nothing about Polish American culture, and you pretty much loaded the book with little details about it.
Oh,
things
thanks.
Like Dingus Day or something like that.
Dingus Day. So Dingus Day is the day after Easter. And so it's always a Monday. And it is a big deal in Buffalo. If anybody's interested, just Google Dingus Day in Buffalo, New York. If you are into fun parties and beer and pierogi and kielbasa, that's the day for you. But traditionally, I've read different legends about this, that Dingus Day meant the girls chase the boys and whip them with pussy willows, and then to pick the boy they want to marry. But I've also read where it said, no, it's the boys chasing the girls. I don't know. I do associate pussy willows with Easter and Dingus Day, because it was just something you always had, and someone had it in a vase, you know, in there, or really it was shrubs growing in the backyard. This was prior to Martha Stewart. now you see them in vases and it's all lovely. But for us, it was like, oh, if they were, you know, budding by then, that was great. That meant we were going to have a decent spring. Spring doesn't come too early. It doesn't come soon enough in Buffalo after the winter. So yeah, Dingus Day it's a big deal. And it would be a big deal for a butcher shop to supply the kielbasa for that. And you know, I was just home. I go back and forth a lot. My family's still in Western New York and in Buffalo. And so there's that. I got some giveaways for readers. Oh. I'm not sure how I'm going to do it. I'm having a book signing with a kielbasa grilling at my local bookstore here in Pennsylvania, because the book comes out July 4th. And Michelle, the bookstore owner, said, well, let's do a release thing on July 4th. I'm like, on a holiday? She was sure. She was, readers love to come out early. And so, and my son decided to take time off work. And I'm like, okay. So he's going to grill the kielbasa for me in the parking lot. It's going to be hot. Well, I can't say it's going to be hot. I'm talking to you in Arizona. But it will be humid. So he's going to take care of that. I'll be signing books and talking to readers in the bookstore. But I thought this would be a fun giveaway. I stole the Kishka. Kishka is a, it's a sausage in Buffalo, and it's kind of a joke. And I use that expression in book two. I didn't know it for the first book. And then the other giveaways I'm doing, I tried to grow my own marjoram. I mentioned that spice, and, or maybe it's majoram. I'm probably not pronouncing it right, but that is the difference with Polish kielbasa. And I think of this as like, it's like a Polish oregano. Now this is a golden majoram, but my local nursery had these on sale. So it helped, because the seedlings I tried to plant, I mean, they're so tiny, you'd need a microscope to see them. I don't think readers would be impressed with that kind of giveaway. And then I thought this was fun. So I want to get my son to wear this when he barbecues. I don't know if I will, but maybe I'll wear it.
There you go.
And so you mentioned like Dingus Day and fun things. These are socks with a butter lamb.
I never heard of that.
Yeah. I talk about, I should have brought it upstairs here. We still have a butter lamb in the refrigerator because butter doesn't go bad from Easter time because we didn't get to use it. We've had some family drama going on and everybody's okay, but there was some health stuff. And so I didn't get to make the usual Easter dinner. So the butter lamb's still sitting in the refrigerator. But this is what they look like. This is a pair of socks. I don't know if I'll do a reader giveaway on Facebook or Instagram. I feel like it doesn't reach enough readers. I think what I should do is do it in my newsletter when I announce that the book's out and give the loyal newsletter followers a chance to enter that. But yeah, so did I answer all your questions on Dingus Day?
I think so, yeah. I still have a few more because it's such a rich book. There's so many layers to it. Why 1980s? Did you just want to revisit your time in Buffalo versus a contemporary setting or?
Well, what happened is I planned it to be contemporary, and the twist I wanted with my character was that she's vegan and has to come back and work in her dad's butcher shop. I thought that would be kind of hilarious, actually.
Yes.
But then I was discussing it with my agent, she loved the whole idea. She loved Lydia and the grandmother right away. She thought that would be fantastic. I'm leaning into writing what I know. Staying in my lane, basically, because that's always where the best stories come from. And just keep it simple. As writers, I know me as a writer, I go down the research rabbit hole and I want to bring everything into my books. And as a reader, I'm not going there for that. Just give me the story that I'm looking for. I pick whatever genre it is for a reason. And that's what I try to do. So I told my agent, well, I'm going home. I'm going to have to do a lot of research because I haven't lived at home since I was a certain age in 1982. I said, I haven't lived there since I was 19. And she said, well, unless you said it in 1982, I just had a big 60 birthday here this month. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be here and be able to do this. And then I'm still writing. But at any rate, she said, well, what if you said it in 1982? People love the 80s. And I'm like, yeah, I love the 80s, especially the early 80s. And Buffalo and Chickamauga and Western New York is so rich with cultural and historical, societal, demographic information from that time, because it was right after, you know, Bethlehem Steel was shutting down. My grandfather worked for Ford for 40 years and retired from there. Like there's such a rich history there. And understanding, you know, I guess I was in the generation where we saw people just so depressed about Buffalo. And I didn't really understand why till I read, there's a book that came out quite a while ago, maybe 30 some years ago, called City of Light. And I should have that written down.
Is it
here with
Bell the other or something?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful historical novel. And it really shows how Buffalo was set up to be the Paris of North America. With Niagara Falls and electricity, but it didn't quite happen. And so it's like that kind of cloud has hung over Buffalo this whole time, but not anymore. I mean, Buffalo's thriving, vibrant, and they have the medical corridor, which has just attracted so many people of tremendous talent to the city. So just great things, and things that when I was growing up were like seen as signs of, oh, they're closing it down, the grain elevators. They always made Cheerios there. The General Mills factory was there. And now they're up, you know, I think they've turned them into condos. And that's like on my list of many things to do as part of my research. Every time I'm home, I'd like to take a Buffalo River cruise. And I've never gone on the Maid of the Mist with Niagara Falls. And I can't get my cousins or I can't get anybody to go with me. Like, I don't want to do it. The locals are like, I'm not doing it, but I'm going to go on the Maid of the Mist and see Niagara Falls in a new light.
There's also, it's set in a butcher shop in that neighborhood. Again, a subject I don't know much about, but there's a real art to butchering. It's like anything. What kind, Is this something you were naturally interested in? Did you do research? How did you learn the art and craft of butchering?
Well, I mean, it would take years to learn it, right? Yeah. YouTube videos helped a lot. We had a local butcher shop here in Mechanicsburg where I lived that unfortunately the butcher, he closed it because he was an artisanal butcher. And he told me I could come in anytime and get a meal there because he had a little cafe and watch him, but he closed before I could do that. So most of my research was done online and with YouTube. And just, I've cooked my whole life, and I grew up next to my Polish grandma watching her cook, so, and my mother. So there are things that I just knew, and what I didn't know, I Googled.
Did you, in your family, did you make sausages at home? Was that something that?
I was never a witness to it, but I know my grandfather did, and his family came over. He was born here, but his parents came straight over from Poland, and they catered in the area. And my grandmother worked for them. So she worked for her in-laws as a caterer. So my grandmother did more of the baking, and my grandfather was the cooking person. And so I know that they did make it, but as soon as they could buy it from someone else, I think they did. I think that was also a status symbol. You know, I'm kind of, this is coming to me as I'm talking to you, because being able to shop in a regular grocery store was, you know, something only well-to-do people did. And the famous market there is the Buffalo, the Broadway market. And that's where everybody goes to get their fresh Polish food and veggies. And now it's multicultural, but at Easter time, it is definitely still, it's the prime place to go. My brother texted me a couple weeks before Easter this year saying that he was there, and he'd like to think that he was sitting in the same banquette, you know, a booth at the diner that maybe one of our ancestors did. And I have memories of going to the Polish, to the Broadway market with my grandma as a little girl, because we lived upstairs of them until I was three in downtown Buffalo.
Now, actually, the Kielbasa Queen is not your first mystery series. You started another series, Shop Around the World, if I remember correctly.
Right, with Thule Publishing, and I think, yep, here we go. The second book, the first book was A Santa Stabbing, that came out last November, and this book, A Midsummer Murder, just came out in April. That's book two. And book three, I just have a cover for it. I don't know if that'll show up. Wasp in the Woods. That comes out at the end of August. And that is a contemporary cozy mystery about a former retired now Navy pilot who, she's widowed. She moves back to her hometown of Stonebridge, Pennsylvania, which I based on Mechanicsburg. Mechanicsburg is such a quaint little town. And it's so easy to base anything on that. And she falls in love, spoiler, with the barista. There's a sexy silver fox barista who works in the coffee shop, which my husband, who has gray hair, happens to work in the local coffee shop here in Mechanicsburg as a barista. That's what he wanted to do after he was done with his Navy. And he had a job immediately after the Navy in corporate. And then once the kids were done with college, he switched to making coffee, which is kind of cool and interesting. I never would have expected it. But Angel Warren is an interesting woman because she wants to bring what she's seen around the world to her local hometown in central Pennsylvania. And she wants to do it in a fun way. So she opens a gift shop that's an international gift shop. Some people might call it a curio shop. And of course, dead bodies show up and she has to solve the crime. And the first dead body is in the store, in the shop. And there's not a cat in the series yet, but there are several dogs, and Angel has a talking parrot, which I do too. So I didn't have to do a lot of research there. I've kind of lived it. I have scars on my fingers. are my research with our parrot, who's now 35 years old.
Wow. And it also gives you in that series the chance to talk about a little bit about different holidays and cultures. Is that correct?
It does. So again, I just love holidays. I love, you know, Christmas is, I always would say, would be my holiday, but I love Easter too. Growing up, Easter was a big deal. Christmas was a big deal, and Halloween's become even bigger. And that was always such an exciting time as a kid to me. I mean, anything, you know, my drug of choice was always sugar. for sure, for many, many years and decades. And so, yeah, I get to talk about how maybe Angel has perceived holidays around the world, and I can bring in Diwali. And I'm really lucky because my editor at Thule Publishing, who publishes this series so well, I mean, the books are so beautiful. And if you're a reader and haven't discovered Thule Publishing yet, they do a beautiful job.
They do.
With all their books. And they just started with this mystery imprint not too long ago, maybe a year or two ago. And it's going gangbusters. They are two of their mystery series. I think it's two of the mystery series already are in, they're going to go to production for TV series, which is exciting.
Well, yeah, they're very Hallmark kind of esque quality.
Yeah, exactly. And So my editor at Thule actually is married to an Indian. So she was thrilled to see that I had mentioned Diwali, and she was able to make sure I kept it authentic and didn't misstep there.
Mm-hmm. Now these two different series were your first attempts at mystery writing before mm-hmm. you'd written romantic mm-hmm. suspense, romance, mm-hmm. Women's fiction. Was that a difficult shift? Because mysteries structurally are a little bit different than those other genres.
They are a little bit different, but no, I think it's always, you know, hindsight being 20/20, I think I've always been a mystery writer, and that's why I had to really push and reach to be successful in the romance genre, which I was. I mean, it was, and Harlequin was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience for me, and I got to write so many books in my own series that I love. So now what I'm finding is that all of that has served me so well, because I don't have as much room to go into relationship issues, nor should I, unless they're pertinent to the mystery plot. Mm-hmm. But yet I think it's enabling me to make the characters more full-bodied. Like, I just got revision notes on the second book in the Kabasa Queen series, and none of the notes say you need to develop your character more. None of the notes that it says your mystery plot's, you know, solid. What it is more about developing suspects. I don't mm-hmm. have enough suspects on the page, which makes sense. You know, the red herring thing. Also, I don't have to shy away. There's some subjects I've shied away from because of suicide, because when you see a dead body of especially after, sadly, what we've gone through with the pandemic and the heroin, the opioid epidemic, it would be natural to normal and healthy and expected to always have to rule out suicide, if you know. Whereas when I'm writing a book and it looks like the dead body could have been there because of suicide, I'm nervous about talking about it because I don't want to trigger anybody. Mm-hmm. But of course, if somebody's going to be triggered by a dead body, they're not going to be reading my books anyway forever. There's been dead bodies in all my books. But still, I want to be a responsible author mm-hmm. and writer. And I don't want to make light of suicide because, mm-hmm. I mean, my family has, you know, had its battles and sufferings with mental illness. And I don't know any family that's not touched by that. So I want to be sensitive, but I also want to be practical. And what I'm learning is that mystery readers and the mystery genre, it's okay. I can lean into it. It's okay to put my mind in the investigative mode, which is really what I did in the Navy as an intelligence officer, like putting facts together. That's all that is, putting facts together and making the story. So, the shift has been to just lean into things. And that could just be more because I've matured as a writer and the stories are mature. They're meatier stories, even though you can't go by word count. I've learned too in mystery mm-hmm. because a meaty mystery has nothing to do with how many words it is or any story, but definitely mystery. I mean, some of the short story mysteries are blow your socks off, you know, and stick mm-hmm. with me longer than a 100,000 word novel.
I mean, just look at Agatha Christie and Then There Were None.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing book for that
mm-hmm.
Amount of word count. You've written, is it more than 30 books now? Or
More than 35. I was 35. Trying to figure it out. Like, do you count the novellas I wrote? I guess people do count novellas, and I did online reads for Harlequin. So yeah, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. Yeah.
That's a lot of books to your credit. If you could go back to when you were first starting out as a writer, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, everybody always says this, and it's cliche at this point, but to enjoy the process, just be grateful for where I'm at. I put too much pressure on myself at conferences. I used my Navy skills of networking, thinking that that would make a difference. And it's not that it doesn't make a difference. It absolutely does. You and I met through Romance Writers of America and my editor. I met my editor through Romance Writers of America because I met her through Debbie Maycomer, whom I met in my local writing chapter. I mean, that's all. And Debbie is the one that Susan Wiggs, who is also in my chapter, said, hey, you need to send this to Debbie because you should be published by now, because I was just having the hardest time, you know, getting sold. And it was because I couldn't figure out. I couldn't figure out what subgenre of romance I belonged in. Mm-hmm. And you know, so networking definitely did make a difference. However, as my first editor, who's now retired from Harlequin, always said, relax and just, you know, she was very old school, and she didn't think you should be writing like authors. Now, I've written at least half a dozen books in a year at one point with Harlequin, because that's just what happened. You know, when the market blew up, digital publishing really changed the world for everybody. It's great if you're a reader. Very hard if you're the writer trying to meet reader expectations of so many titles a year. But I am grateful for that, because I look at that as kind of a training period, and it helped me develop my writing skill more than ever. But I would tell myself to relax, don't focus on promotion and all that, and do what I originally set out to do. I put all my marketing and promo money in my website, and I continue to do that. I'm really blessed to have a wonderful web team, Wax Creative. They do Julia Quinn's website, and I got with them early on. I'm really, really lucky again. And I've been working with Emily at Wax forever, and they have a wonderful portfolio and they know authors. But how prescient was that? I'm thinking of Emily Kotler at Wax Creative, always emphasizing you always own your website. There's nothing else that you own. And now with social media always changing and what's mm-hmm. going to work and what's not going to work. So I don't chase the current things. I love Instagram because I love photographs. I love taking pictures. That's an easy way for me to stay in touch with readers, because then I just have that post to my Facebook author page, which I don't go on as much, but readers do. Readers really like Facebook author pages. And so that's a wonderful way to connect. And then also the other promo I will do is like reader groups. Thule has a wonderful readers group that's always fun to, you know, do posting with on the day your book comes out. But I'd tell myself to relax. Don't worry about the promo as much, because there's just so much we don't have control over. Now, if I was an indie author, that doesn't work. You have to really be a marketing genius to be successful at indie publishing especially, and have some marketing savvy for sure, which many people do, and they're doing wonderfully.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because it really is. It's almost like the Wild West in publishing. Mm-hmm. Now you mm-hmm. don't know what you're doing. And I think you said something that really was important that I would underscore. From a reader's perspective, we have expectations of authors that sometimes are unrealistic. Not mm-hmm. every author can write 4 books mm-hmm. a year or 8 mm-hmm. books a year. Some authors write 1 book every other year, and that's their mm-hmm. speed. And you can't judge authors against mm-hmm. each other. They're each unique kind of mm-hmm. people.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing I've learned. I've taken a step back and just slowed down. And that way I can focus. Like, I'm going to focus 100% on my revision notes, and editorial comments to make the second Kabasa Queen book just as good as the first, if not hopefully better. It's exciting. I'm excited about that book, but I'm excited about every book. Like Nora Roberts says, what's your favorite book? The one I just finished or the one I'm going to start, right? But yeah, it for me, it's just where I'm at in life too, probably. I'm not interested in doing that many books at once anymore. It's just doesn't work for me, but it did for a while and it was great while it did.
Let's change direction a bit and talk about Jerry as a reader. What's on your summer reading list this year that you'd like to share?
Well, let's see. I'm finishing up Secret Identity by Alex Segura, which is a glimpse into the comic book world, which I know nothing about. And it's a solidly written mystery as well and well-deserved of all the accolades it got. I can't wait to start A Cold Day in Hell by Lissa Marie Redmond, who I haven't met yet, but she's from Buffalo and has a very successful series with my publisher, Severn House, the publisher for the Kielbasa Killer. So I look forward to meeting her, and she's going to be at my local Mechanicsburg Mystery Bookstore when I'm in Buffalo. I need to reach out to her and maybe meet her. She might think I'm a crazy reader, but her books look really good. They're about cold cases, and she's a former Buffalo police officer. So how cool. I can't wait to read Welcome to Beach Town by Susan Wiggs, who is a longtime favorite. And as you heard me mention, an incredible mentor who's always been so generous with me. Razorblade Tears by S.A. Crosby. I haven't read that yet. I'm trying to catch up with all these phenomenal authors who are going to be honored at BoucherCon this year or not. I don't, you know, but I know they're going to be there. So I want to be able to know more about them through their fiction. Paper Cuts by Ellery Adams. Ellery Adams remains one of my favorite cozy mystery writers. IQ by Joe Ide. I'd like to start reading that series. That was recommended to me by my neighbor, who's a voracious reader. And I did start it, but had to put it down, and I'm going to go back and read that book. It's great. I love his writing and the protagonist, and it's fantastic. And what was the other one on here? Oh, Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. That's definitely one, but I know that'll take a little bit longer. And with going into revisions, I'm not going to read a cozy mystery while I'm doing revisions on my own cozy mystery. I'm not worried about anything seeping into my book. We each have our own voices, and I'm never worried about that that much, but I just need a break from cozy world, you know, when I'm living it and writing it, and I need to read something different. And I'm always reading nonfiction, you know, daily. I love reading anything about mystics, no matter what walk of faith they are. I love Mirabai Starr's, I've been reading her. She writes a lot about feminist spirituality. So that's cool. I hate to even use that word. It's overused nowadays with spirituality, but just reading about things that are mysteries in life and unknown to me, and something I'm not going to figure out in this lifetime. I love reading things like that.
That's a very eclectic and impressive list. Tells, I think it's really great that you read outside a certain genre, because so often we tend to get boxed into what we think we like and we don't take chances on other books we might really love. We're almost out of time, but before we have to let you go, can you tell us again, you said you have a website, so how can readers find out more about you and your books?
They can find me at jerrycroto.com. You could scan that too if you're watching this on your computer or your TV, and that'll take you to the actual series page, but jerrycroto.com, and it's just like my name spelled, GerryKrot as in Tom, OW.com. And I have had that website for a long time. Like, I used to do my own website. That was the first thing I learned when I wanted to publish in 2000, was get your own website name as soon as you could claim a name. And I am so fortunate that I did. So that's where you can find me. And I am on Instagram and Facebook.
That's great. Yeah, you're smart to have done that. There's another John Charles out there who's nothing like me. So don't make that mistake if you end up on the wrong website.
Yes, I did. I did Google you looking for your email because it wasn't popping up.
I'm sure he's a lovely person, but we're not really. We have nothing no. to do with each other.
I figured that out pretty quickly.
Yeah. And your new book is The Kielbasa Killer, so that will be available soon.
Yeah, July 4th, because it's a UK publisher. And well, I guess in the US, we're still publishing books on July 4th. But mm-hmm. yeah, so it's really celebratory. I'm excited.
And there's more to look forward to in that series and your other mystery yep. series. I want to thank you, Jerry, for taking time to once again visit us virtually at The Poison Pen and for writing such really wonderful books, a great summer reading.
Oh, thank you.
Year reading. Okay.
Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it.
And thank everyone for tuning in to another author chat at The Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.